Today on Care Under Fire, I'm with Renil Chandra. Chans has had an extensive military nursing career spanning 22 years and has served with the Army, SOTG and the Navy. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Emma, for having me.
I'm really keen to hear about all the facets of your career, the special operations stuff, but also your work in the HA space and in the command and health planning. But is it true when you first called up DFR, you started your career by choice in infantry while you were still studying?
That is correct, yeah.
Yeah. Did that experience, you think, ground you as an officer later on?
Yes, it did. After I finished university and I completed a postgrad year at Liverpool Emergency Department, I thought, I really enjoy this aspect of my career as a rifleman, and even though I enjoy nursing, it is something I can do later on in my life. And so I put my nursing career on hold, and I got a full-time posting to 6RA as a rifleman, and which I posted up there in Alpha Company, 1 Platoon, 6RA.
And were the boys just showing you all their rashes anyway?
It's funny how that happened. So even though I had a nursing qualification, I still had to do a combat first aid course just for, so they had formal recognition as a clinician within the Army. However, when we deployed to East Timor, whenever there was a casualty, the OC or the platoon commander would always ask over the radio, would go, get the medic up there and also get Chandra up there as well. and so the medic and I always worked well together, and especially because I still try to maintain my skills up at 6RA as a nurse, just working casual shifts on the weekend at either Green Slopes Hospital or even at just any agency shifts as well.
And so when did you decide, I'm just going to flick over and do the nursing thing full-time Army?
So it was 2005. And I was on guard duty at 3RA. And if anyone used to drive past the old 3rd Battalion back at Holsworthy, there was always a paratrooper on the front gate on duty. And it was Boxing Day, 2005, and a lot of my medic mates were driving past. And I thought it was a bit strange because everyone was on leave and I'm on guard duty. Really, the base should be empty. And then, however, I walked back into the guard room and realised it was the Bandar Aceh tsunami. And at that stage, with the military, there was only a few little operations going on. And it was at that moment where I thought, hey, I've got a nursing degree. And even though I love infantry and I love many aspects of the job, I'm still not optimising all my qualifications. So that was the moment where I thought, actually, I might as well combine the two and become a nursing officer. And as the following months unfolded, and then hearing catching up with a few friends when they returned from Bandar Aceh, I knew it was the right decision to progress my career as a nursing officer.
I guess you were fortunate to get a trip as a rifleman first up, but you're looking at a situation where, you know, if the battalion's offline for a bit, it might be a few more years. So it makes sense if you want to get amongst things again.
Exactly right, because I was, by that stage I was at 3RA, I had my parachute wings. I was still working at Liverpool Emergency Department around the corner, just doing my weekend shifts, keeping my trauma skills up. And it just made sense getting commissioned and then moving off to parachute surgical team, which was my first posting as a nursing officer.
And how was that?
Yeah, really good. I enjoyed combining both my infantry skills and nursing skills together, and so when I did arrive, I knew it was the right choice.
And that's probably what a lot of new nurses potentially don't recognize, how much of a general officer skills, soldiering skills that they need to do their job well. So you're at a real advantage there.
That is correct. I didn't see it at the time. However, as a nursing officer, I always find it's a balance of being great at your military administration, being good at your clinical skills, and also your field craft, but to be able to operate out field, including, you know, operating weapon systems or even just setting up a hoochie and eating a ration pack. And all those skills combined make you a good nursing officer. Can you master them all or do them all well at the same time? That is a challenge. However, as long as you've got a good balance of all of them and have a good foundation, you know when to lean on onto those each in separate areas, and know when to step up, say your clinical skills as required, or when you're back in barracks, just be able to support your team by being good at your military administration as well.
So when you got posted to two commando, were you just cheering then about combining all your great loves?
Oh, actually, at the time, I didn't even really know what two commando was,
Okay.
and my career advisor said to me, "Renil, you can shoot, you can carry a pack, you can jump out of planes. Have you thought about 4-hour commando?" That's what it was back then. And I thought, actually, really know much about it, but if you're telling me it's a good fit for me and I can continue on with maintaining my infantry skills or field craft and also be a good nursing officer, then yeah, I'm happy to post there. And then as I was leading up towards the posting, I just did a bit more research on it, and a lot of my mates from 3-hour had crossed the road to 4-hour and asked, had a good chat to them as well. And so I thought it's going to be a fantastic couple of years ahead of me.
Yeah, hard work, but
Oh, it is. And it's not just about wearing like cool clothing or operating new cool weapon systems or exciting deployments. A lot of work goes behind the scenes of being an operator in that environment.
yeah. So you're doing all the CBRN stuff, or that was still more the incident response regiment at that point?
That's correct. At that stage, it was all gearing up or building up momentum over in Afghanistan. It was 2008. 4-hour had more of a presence, or two commando now, in Tarin Kaut, and working with SASR as SOT, Special Operations Task Group deployments. And it was all about being as fit as you can, being the best clinician you can, and pushing SF sort of characteristics or skills to the optimum over in that environment to achieve the outcome or the mission at that stage.
So tell me about your Afghan trip and what sort of stands out there.
So leading up to it was a lot of like fitness as well, so lots of webbing runs, lots of time in the gym, but also trying to get as much trauma experience as I can at Liverpool, doing extra shifts as I could, and just trying to work well with the team. But also, even though you're a rifleman from a conventional battalion, SF operations does vary or is different to what is required of you as a clinician. And so just understanding the types of missions that we're about to deploy on, and then how to tailor my skill sets or my experience to support the operators on the ground.
So tell me about your role there.
My role there was in two different spaces. One was providing primary health care, but also, when called upon, providing AME, a response to anyone in the field. And my second role was being a first responder in the field or working in a forward resuscitation team as well.
Are there any jobs that stand out to you or have stayed with you?
Yeah, one of the key or the most important experiences I had during that Special Operations Task Group deployment for me was halfway through the trip when I was back in barracks providing garrison primary health care, but also AME response. And I got a phone call from the SAS team, and they said, "Hey, Chansey, we've got two casualties. There's been a bushmaster hit by an IED, and can you please come to the Soc C?" And so I just grabbed all my gear, walked into the Soc C, and you can see all the TV screens just with all the soldiers on the ground, just doing what they're doing, providing all-round defense and treating the casualties. And so the SAS team, they drove me down to the flight line where there was a Black Hawk already turning and burning. And I already had worked with them a few times already, so they knew I was coming. And so I just jumped on and put my heel strop onto the flight on onto the deck of the aircraft, and then we took off towards the casualties. Whenever you fly or provide AME in Afghanistan, there's always an Apache gunship as escort, and usually we fly with the doors open. And so I just remember the cold air rushing in through the cabin because it was probably about 1 o'clock in the morning then, and myself and the two other pararescue guys in the back just looking at the scenery, and just probably just slowing down a heart rate, just thinking about what we may expect or what we may see at the other end. And as we were getting closer towards the casualty, the pilots just told us that, oh yeah, we're 2 minutes out. So usually when you're about 2 minutes out, you close the doors of the aircraft just in case you receive small arms fire, and then you just prepare to unstrop off the deck. And so that way, where as soon as you hit the deck or hit the landing pad, you can just open the doors and then peel out and then and just move towards the casualties. This time it was a little bit different because as the pilot was getting towards the landing pad, the helo started browning out, which means there was a lot of dust in the air, and the pilot wasn't quite sure exactly where the ground was, so he had to do another flyover. And so we took off, but at this stage, myself and the two PJs weren't strapped to the helo anymore because we were about to just jump out. But however, on the second pass, when the pilot or when the helo came down, it just landed on an area where it wasn't completely flat, and the left wheel just clipped the ground, and the whole helo just tipped over, catching, and then one of the rotor blades just started shredding up. And then once one started shredding up, all the others took off, and then the helo rolled over a few times, and myself and the two PJs at this stage, unstrapped, rolled around the back until the helo landed back onto its belly. The pilot had shut off the engine, and we waited for the dust to settle just to reorientate ourselves because we really weren't sure exactly what happened because it was such a violent landing. As soon as we it all went like the helo landed back on its belly, everything was quiet, we reorientated ourselves, we exited the aircraft because we still had, even though we just went through a hard landing, we knew still knew there was two casualties on the ground, and we just wanted to make sure they were stable. So myself and the two PJs, we moved forward. We were greeted by one of the SAS medics, Wal, and he gave us a quick update on the two casualties, and then we provided further medical treatment. However, a little bit different now because we cannot take off and return back to Karen Kau because the helo was unserviceable. We still had an Apache gunship as escort flying over the top, just providing further security, and we weren't sure when the AME was or secondary aircraft was going to come out to get us. So then we just held there until the secondary aircraft came in the next morning.
So you were in this sort of prolonged field care phase with these guys. Did you have enough resources in that to keep them going?
Correct. So we were in that prolonged field care phase. Luckily, the patients weren't critical to the point we had to immediately evacuate them within that golden hour. They were stable, and we just monitored them and provided further treatment as required, say, such as pain relief, or just made them comfortable until next morning when a CH-47, which was our lift, turned up. And we loaded the two casuals into the aircraft, and then we returned back to Tarin Kowt.
And was that chopper totaled?
The original Black Hawk.
The Black Hawk, yeah.
Yep, that's correct. It was
Wow.
unserviceable. There was two options: either blow it in place or pull off the rotor blades and then fly it back to Tarin Kowt under the belly of the CH-47, which that's what they did. Priority was to get those two casualties out. So myself and the two casualties. We just flew back in that CH-47. When that CH-47 dropped me off with the two casualties, it returned back with the engineering team on board to just prepare the aircraft to be underslung.
Those pilots would have been pretty nervous sitting in a multi-million dollar target on the ground for that long, too.
Yeah, it was like it was a bit surreal because even for myself, I'm a kid from Nowra, who did nursing at Wollongong, and it's like now 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm surrounded by a troop of SAS. There's one bushmaster that's unserviceable, and two casualties on the ground, a downed Black Hawk, a crew on board who, just waiting for to be picked up as well. And luckily, none of us were injured either. And there's an Apache gunship over the top, just providing overwatch. Yeah, and so it was just a surreal moment.
Yeah, you're lucky to be alive.
Correct. Yeah, lucky to be alive. But I think at that moment, like you don't realize how lucky you are until subsequent deployments, or when you start losing friends on future deployments when they had similar accidents, and unfortunately they didn't come home or they were injured.
Across your pretty broad career, what do you think the greatest advances to medical care on the battlefield have been?
The greatest advance to medical care is the golden hour, application of the tourniquet. Are the two main things that just stick out for me?
Yep, being able to be in a forward surgical facility within that hour.
Exactly right. So even every operator on the ground had a tourniquet easily visible in their chest or on their battle rig. All the medics had additional tourniquets in their pouches, plus all their first responder kits as well. And on multiple occasions, that Platinum 10, when you're able to apply a tourniquet, stop the bleed, or even just pack a wound, and then put a cannula in and provide some fluids, keep them warm, and then and reassuring the patient. And then within 30 minutes, there's already a helo inbound, picking up the casualty, and then already en route back to a higher medical facility. Is such a great advance to medical treatment.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned your first posting was to the parachute surgical team. I guess you would have seen a few reiterations of that concept throughout your career. So being able to put a light surgical facility forward and have it really mobile. Do you think we've really figured out the best way to do that yet?
Great question, Em. The parachute surgical team was fantastic in terms of deploying a medical footprint on the ground at short notice, especially if you're already with a attached to an airborne unit. However, once we landed on the battlefield, we'd end up becoming a liability because we couldn't move ourselves and we couldn't protect ourselves. And so you're relying on the unit that you were potentially supporting to support you. And so there's only so much you could do in that moment. The next version that came out of the parachute surgical team, which I was also part of, was the rapidly deployable surgical team. It was still in its infant phase. However, the concept was there of making it not all about being airborne, however, being able mo to be mobile with either a MOG or some sort of mobility element, say ASLAV or PMVs weren't around yet, but yeah, the concept was there. And so we started changing our kits, bringing like larger bin boxes or different types of medical kit, because we were able to move it around the battle space. Fast forward a couple more years later, and then we had the shock trauma platoon, which I was part of again. This was a fantastic concept. It was a small team with two MOGs and a G wagon as a command wagon, and we were able to provide care for 12 prior ones, and then also surgical case five surgical cases before we had to return back to the, for example, back to the hospital to refurb our equipment. The good thing about the shock trauma platoon, about setting up within 60 minutes, and then also pulling down within 90, we're able to move around the battle space, but also not being or slowing down the element that we're supporting either. For example, if a battle group had a bit of momentum, we were able to keep up with them because we had the mobility as well. And so when you have a team that can set up within such a short moment period and then pull down within 90 minutes as well, it provides a great medical facility in the battle space.
Yeah, absolutely. You can do life-saving orthopedic and general surgery, stop the bleed, damage control stuff, and then pack up and move again very quickly.
Exactly right.
Has it actually been used in a HA or other space? Obviously, in Afghan, we were there so long, by the end, there was surgical facilities scattered everywhere and an AME network that's supported that more static function with four medics. But to your knowledge, have we rolled it and used it at short notice?
During my time at Shock Trauma Platoon, I've never used it in an operational space, and I can't answer that question. Yeah, if it has
No,
been
it's all right.
used since I left.
Yeah, I'm just curious. I think you could see more potential in the humanitarian assistance area than potentially more kinetic warfare.
I agree, especially in the HADR space, where moving a field hospital takes so many shipping containers and also the logistics burden on moving it as well. It sometimes like removes us out of that space just because it ends up being too big. And especially in the HADR space, then a lot of the mission planners or even at the higher government levels may decide we may just use civilian organizations because they're probably a bit more nimble compared to a big field hospital, where if you're able to deploy two MOGs and a G-Wagon into the back of a C-17, it would definitely be a game changer on getting a footprint on the ground. The other good thing about, especially in that high-intensity conflict in a denied environment, be able to move between islands or be able to just roll in the back of a C-17 and then and move into another area operation without having to pull down a big field hospital, then set it back up again. It's a bit of a big game changer as well, and I really think that's the way, or my opinion is the way that say military medical should be, especially in the field space.
Yeah. So after what, 18 years in army, what made you want to do a service transfer to the Navy? And at what rank were you at that point?
At that point, after 18 years in the army, I reached the rank of major, which was mind-blowing, especially when I was a rifleman at 6RAR. And if someone told me back then you'd be a major one day, I thought they were crazy. Yeah. However, if you just look for opportunities and keep working hard, good things always happen if you put those things together. And so, I just returned back from Iraq. And it was a really rewarding trip because we were training the Iraqi Defense Force in preparing for the big fight against ISIS up in Mosul, and training hundreds of Iraqis every day, and just being able to teach them just basic medical equipment or medical training such as wound packing or just supporting an airway or putting a tourniquet on was so rewarding, especially when they the feedback they give back to you is like, "You're telling me if I put this tourniquet on, it could save my friend's life," or from their previous experience, they're just reminiscing on some of their friends that had been injured and how, if they knew had this training, how it could have helped their friends in the past as well. So that was a really rewarding trip for me. And so I returned back from Iraq and already reached the rank of major. And I just thought there's only one direction I'm going. It's mainly into administration roles. And I just qualified as a nurse practitioner. And there weren't many opportunities for nurse practitioners in the army back then. And I didn't want to de-skill or lose that qualification sitting behind a desk. So I thought it's time to get out. And so while looking for options, and I was offered a few options in the public sector, and Navy called up and said, "Hey, I heard you're getting out. We understand you're a nurse practitioner, and we'll recognise your scope of practice, and we'll also give you opportunity to do clinical as well. And I thought, oh, this is fantastic. It extends my career for a few more years, and I get to continue maintaining my clinical skills, which I did because I returned back down to Sydney and I returned back to Liverpool Hospital again, working as a nurse practitioner in fast track on my clinical days, and just yeah, it was a really good fit for a couple more years.
How did you find that culture change between Army and Navy?
Oh, the great question. I found that this is only my own personal
Yeah, of
opinion,
course.
and everyone's experience is different. For me, the culture of army is all about teamwork and winning the land war, and you do everything you can in your day-to-day duties, such as PT, weapons training, clinical placements, field craft, to win the land war. And I think it's only because the army was in the operational space for quite a few years in Iraq and Afghanistan, where that mindset had been fixed or solidified. And like with the Navy, it was a little bit different because they hadn't been in a large-scale conflict for many years. And a lot of people I served with in the Navy had never experienced that environment either. So even coming into a resource bay, on the LHDs, which I my first role was team leader resus for both HMS Adelaide and Canberra. When I came on board, there wasn't even a tourniquet in the resus bay, and even talking to my team, they did not have much trauma experience. A lot of the medical treat experience they had was looking after someone got burnt in the galley, or someone who fell down the stairs, or like injuries that would occur around the ship. And I said, hey guys, like we got to change direction. Our role is to look after the 800 people who are going to leave the line of departure, which is either going to be down in the well dock, or they're going to leave from the flight deck, and they're going to be moving towards the beach, and they're going to be returning back to the ship with a variety of so injury profiles that we haven't trained for yet, but we'll get there together. And so that's the start of my first couple of years in Navy. And yeah, we grew really quickly. We developed some SOPs, and I know they're going in a positive direction. Just looking after or focused in that space of not just looking after someone who hurt themselves on board the ship, but also gunshot wounds, blast injuries, all those things that we've saw in Afghanistan and Iraq.
Yeah, that blows my mind to think that a lot of the research out of Afghan and Iraq wasn't already being implemented in a tri-service setting.
I guess it's like it's no fault of the nurses at the time in Navy. I guess it was just probably they weren't exposed to it, and when they had the 800 soldiers on board, it was still a very new concept for them as well, because LHDs really only came into service around 2014, 15. They started developing the SOPs for the amphibious task group. And which is like amazing that they can do it so quickly. Till I arrived in 2018, where we had helicopters leaving a flight deck and soldiers leaving from the well dock, to be able to force project a huge capability onto a beach, the growth curve was huge. And so I was just, for me, I felt like, I get it, but and I accept the challenge, and I'm happy to build that space, which we did.
Yeah. And they're not just training for one mission, they were training for all of them, really. The HADR, the border protection stuff, and in whatever other role they might be short notice deployed to. So, yeah.
Exactly right. And we proved that later on down the track when we had the bushfires, or we had to go to Fiji on HADR as well,
Yeah.
and then also the multiple sea series exercises up in Shoalwater Bay.
Where people get injured just because there's 20,000 soldiers on the exercises. So So something's going to happen.
Oh, exactly right. It's just it's a numbers game. Yeah, if when you have that many moving parts and you have fatigue added to it, and then also potential risk of helicopters taking off or boats leaving early hours in the morning, there is always going to be a potential risk of someone getting hurt. However, one of the things I really believe is soldiers will do anything if they have confidence in their medical system. And so just be able to, give them a walk through the emergency department and go, hey, if you get injured, and this is the emergency department that you're going to come to, and this is the operating theatre that, that you may potentially need if required. Hopefully you don't need it. And just giving that reassurance that, hey, if something does happen, they're going to get the highest level of care. And so some of the SOPs I developed while my time in the Navy was exactly what I'd experienced or trained at Liverpool Hospital, because I consider that as one of the centre of excellence in terms of trauma care. And so whenever I deployed with the ship, I believe that we should be able to provide as much or the best quality of trauma care that we can to even the standard to what you should receive if you hurt yourself back in Australia.
So as you moved into this J07 role with the Navy, do you want to just give us a rundown of what that is and what they're responsible for?
Oh, I can do that. So I'll just set the scene. It was 2020, and Fiji was just hit by a cyclone, and we were also in a pandemic where Queensland was COVID safe. New South Wales had elements of COVID in it as well, and it was also a contested environment in the Pacific Ocean where we had foreign navies in the area as well. And we had to deploy to Fiji to provide humanitarian aid and disaster relief, and then also ensure with the Fijian government that we were the partner of choice when it came to this sort of support required. It was the 19th of December, we set sail from Sydney Harbour up to Brisbane, and I remember that morning it was so dynamic where I was getting phone calls or text messages or meeting up with people, and they were just telling me that, hey, I got exposed to someone at a gym or at a or a family get together a week ago. I got this text message, am I safe to go? And I had to make decisions on the spot, go, actually, you're unsafe. You stay at home. We need to find a replacement for this person. So as the senior health officer on board, and also we didn't really have a full amphibious task group attached to us as well. And so for me as the senior health officer on board HMS Adelaide, I had to make those decisions really quickly. The reason why it was so important to make those decisions was we could not risk being another Ruby Princess to the Queensland government, because they were unsure whether to even let us come up to Queensland. And also we didn't want to become a, like bringing COVID into Fiji where their curve is so much lower because they just don't have enough medical support or infrastructure in place either. And so we started sailing up to Brisbane. We knew who we had on board, and the only way to know that we're all COVID safe was to be able to do COVID testing on board the ship, and then move all the COVID tests to a medical facility or a pathology provider in Brisbane. And before we could let everyone board, we had to make sure that we're all COVID free before we could start embarking the soldiers on board from Queensland. So once we knew we were COVID safe, and we embarked all the soldiers from Brisbane and also all the engineering equipment, we started sailing towards Fiji. And then once we arrived in Fiji, same again, we had to create bubbles on the ground to make sure that we didn't interact with the Fijian government or even Fijian soldiers on the ground or villages until we could provide again that we were COVID-free. And so we did this a couple of times, but so we tested everybody on board the ship, and we packaged all the COVID tests with all the pathology slips and everything else required, and we had to fly the COVID test to Nandi Airport, where there was a C-17 waiting for us, which we flew to Brisbane, and then we had 48 hours to get all the tests done and to demonstrate to the Fijian government that we're COVID-free before we could start operations in Fiji for the humanitarian aid disaster relief, and just starting small, like building schools or just cleaning up some of the damage caused by the cyclone.
Wow. So, senior health officer planning the health response, did you do direct HA for the community or were you in support of our trades and engineers?
So a couple of things we're doing. We're providing primary health care and also in case we needed any trauma response, we were there as well. But the main thing is, it was the first time there was HADR, probably from my knowledge, ever in a pandemic environment. And so it was a very dynamic environment. Every single day, I'd be going to meetings, and someone would be asking me, like, how many people can we have in the back of the aircraft? How do we clean the aircraft? What do we do on the shore? It was such a dynamic environment that, there was no training really. For me, I just had to go from my own gut experience and also previous experience, and to just make decisions to keep everyone safe, and then also to make sure that we don't introduce COVID into Fiji, and especially at the fault of the Australian government or the Australian Defence Force. So after we provided HADR, we built a school, we repaired some of the damage, and then we returned back to from Fiji to Brisbane and then back to Sydney, and then we're completely COVID free. In my mind was like, maybe we're lucky, but also, we made sure we put all the plate things into place and then tested everyone frequently, and just I think it was a big success for the Australian Defence Force returning from that mission.
Yeah, absolutely. Just maintaining that COVID safe at the start of the pandemic when we had very little information and delivering that HA assistance successfully. Yeah. Were there any lessons learnt?
The main thing is just having the right equipment on board to do COVID tests, because the ones we had on board, they were fantastic for on the spot testing. However, you can't do them in mass volume, such as 1,200 people on board. And so to be able to just streamline the swabbing, so that way we could buy more time on the right-hand side with the COVID tests in the pathology providers, was a massive lesson learnt. It was really good, because to give them more time ensured that all the tests were done within 72 hours, and that way we'll able to continue on with our mission.
Yeah, so this was well before rapid antigen tests were widely available and that.
Exactly right, and this is before anyone had any COVID vaccines either.
Yeah. So you also did J07 work for, was it bushfire response or the COVID response in Victoria?
So the J07 role was in Fiji. So initially I was just the senior health officer on board, but however, I had to step up into that J0 space as well. And so I was doing health planning upstairs, and then also being the senior health officer on board HMS Adelaide at the same time. I'd love to share you my experience with the Mallacoota rescue. I'll set the scene. It's the 1st of January, and New South Wales and Victoria is burning, and I receive a text message from a friend, and she just asked me, "Are you going on the ship to Mallacoota?" And I said, "I'm not sure what you're talking about, but I only work on HMS Adelaide or Canberra, and at this stage only Chules is going down." And then about half an hour later, my boss calls me, and I just said to him, "Am I guess I'm going to Mallacoota." He goes, "Yeah, you are." And he said to me, "Grab your things. There's going to be a MRH90 waiting for you and the rest of the AME team at Ramwick Barracks in 4 hours." And so we turned around, and my bags are always packed anyway, so I just jumped into uniform, grabbed my bag, and jumped in a cab, and then RV'd with the rest of that medical team at Ramwick Barracks. And sure enough, there was an MRH90 turning up on the footy field to pick us up. And we started flying down the coast, and we RV'd with HMS Chules off the coast of Jervis Bay, and it was heading towards Mallacoota. And there was not much intelligence or information coming back to us from like from the Defence Force channels. It was mainly just from what we're getting from ABC News, because all people on the ground, because they were like, it was such a dynamic environment. We really weren't sure what we're moving into, but the known knowns were all the main roads were cut off. Over 1,000 people were stranded on the beach, and we had to remove them from that threat. And next morning, we arrived in Mallacoota, and myself and the AME team, we got a ride onto the shore. We were picked up, and then we moved to the medical center in Mallacoota. And it was such a busy space, if I could put it in those words, because it was probably the only space where the air was clean because of the filtration or the air conditioning system. And all the elderly and women and children, or anyone injured, or anyone with a medical condition, felt safe. And however, they had nowhere to go. And all I knew was we only had a small window to identify who could fly and who could sail. And so myself and the emergency physicians and who were part of the AME team, and we just quickly did a quick sieve and sort, worked out who are the priorities, and then we just, with a handful of ambos in town, we just put everyone on board who we could into the back of the ambulance, and we just went to the flight line where there were only a few helos, both civilian and military, on the ground, and we just loaded as many people as we could and then returned back to the medical center. Next day, we started the evacuation of Mallacoota, and we just did. It was slow because we had to do multiple ferries or shuttles from the shore into the back of Chules, and also we had to bring all the animals on board as well, because initially the captain wasn't keen, or it wasn't probably on his radar. They had to bring all the animals on board, but we were splitting families if we didn't. Is either mum or dad was going to be staying back in Mallacoota because they had to stay home with their, stay back there for their family pet, and they still weren't sure when they were going to be coming out of Mallacoota as well. So over 1,200 people and over 100 dogs and 3 cats, and there was even a budgie and a bunny somewhere as well. And we boarded HMS Chules, and then we sailed down to Victoria, and which we it was very crowded. Because the ship wasn't designed to have so many people on board, plus the crew, but we just made the best we could. Now, there was families sleeping in hallways, on top of tables. We gave up our bunks, we gave up our showers and all our facilities, and we just made the best we could in a difficult environment and sailed towards Victoria for one of the largest humanitarian aid disaster relief rescues probably in Australia's history. So.
How were the evacuees and their mental state at that point? Basically, watching this mammoth fire encroach and take their homes and town.
Oh, the evacuees, they were very grateful because Mallacoota is a tourist town, so the population swells during the holiday season. And so a lot of the people on board were either residents who were trying to evacuate from the fires, or they were they had their caravans, or they had their cars with their camping gear, and but they couldn't get home, so they were just happy or grateful that they could, just grab whatever they could and get out of there at that moment. They knew they can always go back to it later on and pick up their belongings, but at this stage, a lot of them were tired, and because they've been spent the last previous nights on the beach, because it was probably the safest place they could stay.
Yeah. Would you say probably one of the most rewarding jobs in your career, being able to help at home?
Oh, definitely. It was unexpected, but one of the most rewarding moments of my career for sure.
And how did you decide who got out early on the helos? Were you looking primarily for respiratory problems and very unwell people that wouldn't have coped well with the sea evacuation?
Exactly right. We're just looking at their comorbidities, their age, how well they would fare on an overnight trip on a ship. Even just the stairs on board HMS Chulz, you know, if they had like a mobility issues, how do we get them up and down the stairwells? If they, we still had limited AME on board in terms of like helicopters, so if something did happen to them, it probably put the air crew at risk if we had to fly in the middle of the night to get them to a hospital in Victoria. So we just looked at who could need to get out in terms of potential risk, and so that's how we selected them.
Yeah, and I guess the humanitarian aid space, disaster response and recovery, doesn't get a lot of airtime in comparison to more kinetic operations. Do you think that has affected the individuals that have served on these HA ops?
I guess everyone has varied experiences when they go into humanitarian aid disaster relief. For example, with Bandar Aceh, I still have a few friends who are scarred or have some traumatic memories from that deployment, even though they did lots of good there, but they also saw a lot of things that you just cannot forget. And at the same, like, rewarding, but however, has changed them. Where Malekuta, we didn't have many severe casualties. Mainly we're just looking after, minor trauma or, primary health care.
Yeah.
However, it was very rewarding. And I just look at that as a very positive experience in my life.
Hmm.
I deployed to Victoria and providing COVID assistance. At that very moment, it was Australia's most important thing was to get Victoria out of COVID, because it's impacting the rest of the country. But also, for the people of Victoria, just getting their groceries or the kids going to school or being able to attend their medical appointments, it was a very challenging time for them. So that was very rewarding, just to work with the local health services and just streamline or support COVID testing to slowly get them out of COVID, which was another great success for ADF support to the nation. And so that's a rewarding moment as well. And then Fiji, same again. Even though the casualties were low, it set us up for success a few more years later, as building the relationship between Fiji and Australia. Without a doubt, still we have external pressures from other government, other governments in the region. However, I still believe that Fiji and Australia are the partners of choice. When it comes to those two countries.
What do you think have been the biggest challenges in your career, or more broadly, big challenges for military nurses?
Our biggest challenge for military nurses is how, just be able to juggle clinical, to be a master at your trade, learn field craft, and be able to operate in that field environment. And then also, manage your team, manage your military administration, because that is a part of your role as a military nurse as well. And I just tell any full-time nurse out there, who's in the Australian Defence Force, don't put too much pressure on yourself. Just make sure that you just take every opportunity to learn and grow and keep those skills up in those three areas. And then whenever it counts or whenever you need to lean on one space more than the other, at least you've got that foundation there and to help you to get through that that environment or that problem that you need to work through.
What's next for you, Chance? You're working in that nurse practitioner space still?
Yeah, I am. I'm working in the sports medicine field. I'm really enjoying it. I'm completely out of the Defence Force now. There are times where I do miss the teamwork and I do miss the dynamic environment of being able to deploy on short notices or seeing a crazy part of the world that I've never experienced before. However, I'm really content where I am now. I found a space where I enjoy working and I'm still teaching when I can and and still enjoying my work as a nurse practitioner.
Nice. 22 years of defence service. Thank you for coming on and thank you for your service.
Oh, thank you very much, Em, and thank you for taking the time to capture this my career and share it with other people. I appreciate your time.